Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week our guest is the U.S. National Editor and columnist for the Financial Times, Ed Luce. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, The Washington Post, and Ladder in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting our sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Okay, James, the Trump trial is before the jury. On the facts, I don't think there is any doubt that Trump had his fixer, Michael Cohen, pay off Stormy Daniels not to reveal a sexual encounter with him before the election, and then fix the books to look like he was reimbursing Cohen for legal fees. Still, it is a relatively complicated case, and candidly, it's not hard to see one or two jurors holding out. And then I think an acquittal is out of the question. A conviction would hurt Trump a little, be a convicted felon. A hung jury would, one or two holdouts would help him maybe more than a little. So the next couple of days will be important for this campaign.
Well, I think it, the beginning and middle, it's all a jury. And the power that these jurors are going to have, if assume that there's a conviction, which I don't know, and they explain how they arrived at it, that's going to be more damning than people think. If there's an acquittal, I don't know, people have decided there's not going to be an acquittal, maybe they're right. I don't know, but I've always been kind of impressed with juries. And whatever they come up with, I'm pretty sure they'll have a good explanation for it. And, you know, they've listened to, I don't know, how many hours of testimony and seen how many documents. And, you know, it's like you're leading up to the election and everybody has a prediction and everything is in everybody. And then you have election night and then who cares? The voters weigh in. As soon as the jury comes in, all of the panels and all of the predictions and everything is just going to evaporate. And the truth of the matter is, we don't know. We don't know what evidence that they're going to be considering in detail or how weak or strong it is. And whatever they come to is going to be, I think, going to be well thought out.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there ain't going to be an acquittal. If there's a hung jury, you know, you may get 10 jurors explaining why they voted to convict and two others, and that might be a wash that helps Trump some. Who knows? I want to raise one other point, though, because the Trump team dismissed the fact that Ms. Daniels was paid off in the aftermath of the Hollywood Access tape. Trump lawyer Todd Blanche said the Hollywood Access tape was no big deal. That sort of thing happens, he said, in campaigns all the time. Now, I've covered 13 presidential campaigns, James. You've been involved in a number, and I've never heard of an actual tape where the candidate brags about, quote, grabbing women by the pussy, end quote. Mr. Blanche may be a good lawyer, but either he was ignorant or lying. A number of Republicans in 2016, October, like Paul Ryan, disassociated themselves from Trump following that tape. There was even talk in high Republican circles of getting him to step aside. What saved Trump was the Russian-led WikiLeaks on Hillary Clinton and James Comey's blunder on reopening the email investigation. The sequel of the Hollywood Access tape and then trying to pay off Stormy Daniels is not only logical, it's, I think, exactly what happened.
Well, there's been this kind of rush to minimize this. I actually think a pretty good bit of Fareed Zakaria said something, I think, particularly stupid. He said, you know, if average American did this, he didn't think he'd be indicted. So what average American is going to have sex with a porn star, asked to be beat on the butt with a rolled up magazine, then have a catch and kill story, and then $130,000 payoff for this porn star silence? while the average American was running for president. And by the way, the idea that this is a victimless crime or something is, then what that jury is going to consider is people were entitled to information before they voted, and they were not given that. Under law, they were entitled to know this. So actually, I would be considering the fact that a giant fraud was perpetrated on, I don't know, the 130 million, 40 million people that voted. So I think when you stop and you think about the facts of this case, it's a little more serious than people admit. It's not, I mean, they're not the prosecution, they're not a hush money case. It's a case that people were deprived of information they had before they made a very critical decision that they were entitled to under the law. So there were
because
your victims.
Because of chicanery.
Right.
Because of chicanery.
Because,
right.
Chicanery. Because of deliberate operation to circumvent the law. And so the victim is every person who voted that was entitled to information under the law that they could have had, and they didn't get it. And if that's the way it's framed, I think it's a, you know, it's more than a minor charge. It you know, let's see what the jury says.
But James, let me turn to another legal matter. I have never been convinced over many years that the Supreme Court is an election winning issue, really for either party. But I'm changing my mind now. The latest is that this high court, this Republican court, is slow walking the Trump immunity case. This is the claim that Trump is basically a king. He has immunity from any prosecution of anything he did as president. And they're slow walking to make sure the president doesn't go to trial on the January 6th violence before the election. Now, the court can move quickly when it wants to. Pentagon Papers took weeks, a couple weeks. The pro-Trump Colorado voting case took 25 days. This one is 5 weeks, 36 days, and counting. Justice Gorsuch, only slightly less of a Republican gunslinger than Thomas and Alito, said, yeah, but we're deciding this case for the ages. Do you think he would have had that view if a former Democratic president was seeking immunity? Of course not. Nor would they have decided the South Carolina racial gerrymandering case if it had disadvantaged Republicans. They would have found another way around it. This is a Republican Supreme Court with little regard for ethics. And I think when you combine it with overturning Roe, with the Dobbs decision, the court is on the ballot this November.
Well, shit, it's been on the ballot since Dobbs, and it's lost every time. And it's gotten nothing but worse. Look, any strategy that Democrats have, this has got to be like front and center. And by the way, the entire court, and what people have to come to understand, they don't give a shit, all right? Alito, he doesn't care. All right, he doesn't see anything wrong with him extending out so Trump can't go to trial. He doesn't see anything wrong with his naked partisanship. He doesn't see anything wrong with Martha Ann calling a neighbor a C-word. They don't care. Thomas doesn't care. John Roberts' wife was a headhunter for law firms that practiced before the Supreme Court, made $10 million. He doesn't give a shit. And we have to understand that. And Biden needs to make front and center a campaign that the Supreme Court subject itself to the same rules as federal district judges had. They ought to precipitate a constitutional crisis because we are losing faith by the day in a third branch of government. And the third branch of government really doesn't give a shit what we think. And the faster we get over that, the better off we're going to be.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and it's really a disgrace. It is the Republican Supreme Court. It's not the United States of America Supreme Court. It is the Republican Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes, and I don't think they care if you think that, or I don't think they care if 60% of the country thinks that. I think that they feel like they are got through a lifetime appointment, and they'll do just what they want. Thank you. They don't feel any pressure. And I don't know what the three liberals on there doing, but eating meatloaf on Friday. I mean, good God almighty, you know, somebody's got to really draw attention to this. I don't know why the three liberals don't do voluntarily financial disclosure or something. Set a bar. Try to embarrass these people in every way that you can. But, you know, they like having lunch together. So I'm not very impressed with them either, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll stay on this, but, you know, it's depressing. I think it's bad for the country to watch a court become as partisan as this court has become. James, today we have one of our very favorite guests, Ed Luce, the chief U.S. commentator and columnist for the Financial Times, grew up on British politics, has covered the world and knows politics all over the globe, including especially in America. Ed, let me start off with your home country. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, inauspiciously drenched by rain outside of 10 Downing Street, called for a new British election for July 4. That's not an historically promising date for the Tories. But why did he do it, as he seems on course to lose decisively? And Ed, what are the prospects of Labour winning an outright majority in Parliament?
Well, great, Alan James, to be on again. It's always a real pleasure. Yeah, July 4th is an interesting date. I, you know, it's my second favorite American holiday after Thanksgiving, but I suspect if the British polls are right, I will be celebrating July 4th this year with more than customary fervor, because we've had 14 years of Conservative government in Britain that has, I think, done more self-inflicted damage at a time not of war, not of particularly difficult economic challenge, self-inflicted, unforced errors that have changed Britain's trajectory to a remarkable degree downwards. And so the reason Sunak called the election now, this snap election, was he had to call it by December. That's the end of the five-year parliament. He has discretion when he can call it. And he saw the economic numbers for the fall, for the autumn, and realized that although things are looking pretty bad right now, they would be even worse in the autumn and in the winter when would have been the last opportunity to call it. So is it going to be a wipeout? Well, the latest polls that I saw today show Labour on 47% and the Tories on 20%. Now, I'm sceptical of that, but if that poll were to be translated into actual polling day, this would be a wipeout that would exceed Blair's Labour landslide of 97, Thatcher's Conservative landslide of 1979. It would be on a par with Clement Attlee's Labour victory in 1945 at the end of the Second World War. I think polls will inevitably narrow in the next 5-6 weeks, but we're looking not just at a Labour majority, but quite a big Labour majority.
Ed, let's talk about Labour. The three most notable Labour leaders in this century, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, sort of the British Bill Clinton and Barack Obama types, more like that, and radical socialist Jeremy Corbyn. Where does the current leader, Keir Starmer, fit in that lineup?
Keir Starmer doesn't fit too well in that lineup. He's he reminds me often of German politicians. He's deliberately trying to be boring, and he is quite boring. And that makes it incredibly difficult for the Conservatives to scare the electorate about what Labour plans to do. He just seems quietly competent. He's not an orator by any means. He's very, very cautious, perhaps too cautious in putting out plans. He's given the Tories nothing to aim at. He has a Stalinist type grip on the Labour Party, in terms of purging it of Jeremy Corbyn's momentum, far left momentum movement, in terms of stamping out any sort of vestige of anti-Semitism in Labour's ranks, up to and including expelling Jeremy Corbyn from the party. It's made him unpopular on the left in Britain, but it's made him electable, and not just electable, perhaps historically electable in terms of the landslides, with the sort of scenarios we're seeing sketched out.
And one thing, he, as I am reading, he started out an all-out Israeli supporter after October 7th. But like his constituency, he's moving away, a little bit like Biden, maybe more so. He's calling for an immediate ceasefire. You know, Bibi Netanyahu, as you know better than us, wants to keep this conflict going and stay out of jail. He's not going to pay any attention to the Brits or to Joe Biden. I guess my question is, how much of an issue will Gaza be in the last 5 weeks? And will Starmer propose to join Ireland, Norway, and Spain, recognize a Palestinian state, perhaps suspend arms sales to Israel?
I'm not sure whether that's yet formal policy, but you see Labour Party front benches, that means the sort of senior shadow cabinet, saying that they would be in favour of that. It's clearly time to pressure Israel. And the Irish and the Spanish and the others have annoyed the Israeli foreign minister, who has been tweeting out, thanks Ireland, to the images of Hamas rampaging. There is clearly a lot of popular support for a ceasefire and for Britain being more even-handed between the Palestinians and the Israelis. I don't think it's going to be that massive a campaign issue, because there isn't a radical difference between the parties on this. And by the same token, Ukraine, unlike in America, in fact, Ukraine isn't really a source of partisan division. This is sort of one of the shoes, thankfully, very few populist shoes that hasn't dropped in Britain. There is generally a sense of unity in support for the Ukrainian cause. There is no sort of Trumpian Putin sympathizing. Well, there is, but they're insignificant.
That's good news, because that may be one of the few good legacies of the conservative regime. You spoke of it earlier, but Brexit, the economy, healthcare. Boy, Ed, I mean, what are they going to tell the children?
It's quite hard looking at the last 14 years. You know, David Cameron came in 2010, 2 years after the financial crisis. Gordon Brown was Labour Prime Minister, and Brown actually was doing the textbook right thing in terms of fiscal policy, which is that you have counter-cyclical fiscal policy. The private sector was saving, as in cutting, so the public sector was dissaving, as in spending, to make up for that. It was exactly what happened in the first 2 years of Obama. Then in 2010, you get Cameron, George Osborne, his Chancellor of the Exchequer. And of course, in the same year, you get the Tea Party. So both Britain and America went from the right fiscal response to a period of austerity. And then, of course, Brexit happens. It's, I think, no surprise that 6 years later after austerity, people are not feeling good. But the impact of Brexit has been quite extraordinary. It wasn't the sort of sudden crash that those arguing for Remain predicted. It's been a slow puncture, but we've now had 8 years, and that slow puncture is really showing up in the numbers. Britain's the laggard of the G7, by far the slowest growing, by far the worst poverty numbers, children in poverty. One third of British children are under the official poverty line. The National Health Service waiting list, which is a really important measure of people's well-being, is tripled to 6.4 million people waiting for operations. The number of public libraries has gone down by a third. The number of food banks, I saw recently a really telling factoid. Food banks which give out food to those who can't afford it. There are now more food banks in Britain than there are McDonald's outlets. I can give you the sort of macro numbers, but numbers like that tell the story a lot better. people are rightly feeling a lot poorer. The young in particular are feeling that their prospects have been robbed from them. Therefore, the electoral verdict we're about to see, I think, on July the 4th, is richly, richly deserved.
James Carville.
So Ed, everything you say, I mean, the story of modern Britain, you know, clearly since 2010, is a story of pretty significant decline. Is there any mechanism to unring the Brexit bell? Or you're just stuck with that as a nation?
That's a really good question. It's kind of one of the key ones, if not the key one, James. Keir Starmer, you know, as part of his cautious don't rock the boat, he has this famous phrase, but politics should tread more lightly on people's lives. There's been too much politics. There's been a sort of permanent puerile radicalism that's become increasingly worse in the last few years from the right. It's also on the far left, but particularly from the governing party. Over Brexit, getting Brexit done, Brexit's been betrayed, we've got to do Brexit properly. Just this sort of rolling revolution, which has exhausted people. And therefore, Starmer has taken, I think, the probably wise electoral stance, but the unexciting one of saying nothing will change vis-a-vis Brexit and Europe. A period of continuity and boringness is required. Unfortunately, that's not going to stimulate the animal spirits that Britain desperately needs to raise its investment rates, to create the jobs and income growth that has been so lacking. So the best you can really bet on is that after being re-elected for a second term in 2029, a Starmer-led Labour government will be in the position to say we would like to rejoin the European Union. And public opinion polls show, you've probably heard the phrase hashtag regrets it.
Right.
Public opinion polls show that more than 60%, some up to 2/3 of Britons would like to rejoin the European Union. They regret, they have buyer's remorse with a vengeance.
Yeah, pretty. So, I know you're excited about your Brzezinski book. How would Brzezinski grade the foreign policy of the Biden administration, particularly like Ukraine, Middle East, China? Do you think he would be in accordance with the general direction, or would he have specific criticisms that he would make?
I think he would. That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think Brzezinski would be B plus, even A minus to the administration's Ukraine policy. Perhaps that would have slipped from A minus to B plus because of some of the caution that Biden's been showing. Caution that was very understandable in the early stages of Ukraine's fight against the Russian invasion when we didn't know where Putin's red lines were. Now that we know his bluff can be called, I think that, you know, perhaps Brzezinski would be criticizing Biden for not giving more license to Ukraine to target arms hubs and infrastructure networks inside Russia itself. We're sort of getting to the cusp of that being permitted, but I think on China, he would be quite critical. That there is a great difference. Brzezinski, you know, really made his name as the person who knew the Soviet Union was declining and that it was just America's role to accelerate peacefully, if possible, the unraveling, the dissolution of the Soviet Union. He realized that its Achilles heel was all these nationalisms inside the Soviet Union itself. That were simmering with resentment against Moscow, including in Ukraine. Of course, in the Warsaw Pact countries, including his home, his birthplace of Poland. China isn't the Soviet Union. China is not going to unravel. It's not going to dissolve. It might change its political character. I'm sure that he, like all of us, would be strongly hoping it does relax. Unfortunately, it's gone in the opposite direction under Xi Jinping. So Xi Jinping is sort of as much of a shock to our expectations, his hardline nationalism, as Mikhail Gorbachev was a positive shock to what we were expecting of the Soviets in the late Cold War. I think he would be critical of the increasingly self-fulfilling path towards decoupling that we're on. One of the great differences between the Cold War that he was navigating and the one we're living in with China is that China is economically very intermeshed and interdependent with us. That is a leverage we have. That is a strength we have. The Soviets were not. The Soviets were just their own completely basket case, second world economy.
So I'll turn it back to Albert. Some issue very close to my heart and a place very close to your heart. In Delhi, which is the second largest metropolitan area on Earth, the temperature was 126 degrees Fahrenheit. I know that you're just an observer of everything, but I don't think this climate stuff is going to do anything but get worse. And it's getting worse for like hundreds of millions of people. It's hard to say we've underplayed this, but I think we've underplayed it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, this phrase wet bulb, this measure of where the humidity and the heat combined become fatal.
Right.
Is becoming a normal feature of parts of the Gulf, Iran, and South Asia, Pakistan, and India, and little patches around the world when it just used to be almost unheard of. It's now becoming almost annual. So one little anecdote, you know, I used to live in India for 5-6 years, and I went a lot to Rajasthan, and Rajasthani farmers, and this is one of the states that has been worst affected by unseasonal death from heat, is that the farm workers have agitated to start work at 4 a.m. instead of at 7 a.m. because it just becomes unbearable too soon during the day.
Right.
That is a massive change, a huge change. And the great sort of bitter irony of all of this is that, you know, most of in India is now electrified, but there are still like millions of homes that aren't. The stock of carbon in the atmosphere comes from us. The flow might now be coming increasingly from China's and Nigeria's and Indonesia's and India's, but the stock, the sort of chief culprit up there, comes from us. And we're doing a lot of virtue signaling in Europe and in the United States. So look, we're cutting our emissions. We are cutting our emissions, but let's not forget the per capita carbon output of the average American annually is 15 tons. The per capita carbon output of an Indian is 2 tons. So we are not cutting nearly fast enough. And so it's something strongly that's underplayed. I couldn't agree more with the premise of your question, James.
Thank you, Albert. Appreciate it.
That's fascinating. Let me go back to Ukraine. If Putin succeeds in Ukraine, aided by a Trump presidency, what are his next designs?
I think, you know, he signals them very clearly. So if I were in Moldova, or if I were in the Baltics, and if I were in Georgia, I would be feeling acutely vulnerable. You know, the Baltics would, you know, contrary to the false expectations about Ukraine, the Baltics would fold within 48 hours. There is just no hinterland there. They're tiny states. The capitals would be just flooded with Russian paratroopers. Our bluff would be called. These are NATO countries. What would we then do? Would we go to war with the two biggest nuclear powers on Earth? Or would we accept the fait accompli? I don't know the answer to that question. Of course, a lot depends on who's in the White House. Moldova would be therefore, and Georgia, softer underbellies. I would think Moldova has the most to worry about because Georgia is tending in a Putinist direction. It's got this billionaire, sort of Gazprom billionaire, Georgian, Ivanishvili, whose net worth is about 20% of the Georgian economy, and his Georgia Dream Party is slowly Putinizing Georgian politics. So I'd be less worried if I were Georgian. I'd be more worried about what's happening in Tbilisi at home. than about Putin. If I want Moldovan, I would be very, very worried. Even with a sort of a ceasefire in Ukraine where Russia gets to keep the fifth of Ukraine that it has plus Crimea, this would still be, you know, a moment where Putin's looking elsewhere. Where else can I apply the pressure? And Moldova's the lowest hanging fruit. And it's not a member of NATO.
Ed, do our important allies in Europe and in Asia, do they realize that Trump is at least an even bet to be the next president? And how do they view that?
They do. There is a debate going on, particularly in Europe, but I mean in Japan, in a different, more Japanese form, about how do you hedge against, how do you insure yourself against the, you know, possibility of or the even chances of a Trump 2.0 presidency. And there is no sort of unified response. I think it's absolutely clear that, you know, Japan and South Korea could go nuclear tomorrow on Monday. You know, they're all dressed up. It wouldn't take much. It's a turnkey situation technologically. They would go nuclear, could go nuclear on Monday. And they would if they felt that America's nuclear umbrella was being removed, which Trump has promised to do. Europe is more complicated because, as ever, it's, you know, 27, 28 states. With very different politics. And whilst Germany has changed a lot since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, it hasn't changed nearly enough to actually become a leader of an integrated, more robust European defense. You know, it's hard for center-left governments, and Labour will discover this too if they're elected in Britain, it's hard for them to be strong on defense. So I expect, even though Germany could also technologically go nuclear, a Trump administration would induce division and paralysis in the short term. The one exception to this, very interestingly, is Keir Starmer's Labour Party. So the shadow foreign secretary, the man who will be foreign secretary probably in 6 weeks' time, David Lammy, has been to Washington 7 times in the last year since he became shadow foreign secretary, not just to see Biden administration people with whom he's well acquainted, but also to see Trump people like Elbridge Colby, like J.D. Vance, like Marco Rubio, tons of sort of Heritage Foundation people, not the normal, preparatory work for an incoming center-left government in Europe to hang out with right-wing populists who aren't in power in America. But it's another form of insurance is to try and make friends with them, to try and soften their sting or blunt their, you know, potential damage. That's worth watching. I hope, though, it's hypothetical. I hope, you know, that this preparatory work was just due diligence rather than something we'll see put into practice. In other words,
I'm going to turn it back to James, but we've drawn on your expertise on Britain and Asia and Ukraine. How about, I mean, you know as much about American politics as we do. How do you assess the election right now? What odds do you give?
I don't know nearly as much about American politics as either of you. So I'm far more reluctant to speak, with these Oxbridge sentences. And sense of confidence about that. I mean, I'd be fascinated to hear what you think. I think it's a coin toss.
I think we agree. James, why don't you pick up on that?
We'll agree to that. So I'm going to ask you the question that 80% of the people that are listening to this podcast want to know. How is King Charles doing?
Well, I was just texting with him earlier, you know. Yeah. He's doing okay. He's doing okay. I mean, I guess, you know, if there is royal sort of angst around, it's about Princess Kate's, Catherine's cancer.
Right.
And she said she won't, and she is the most popular royal. So she said she won't be doing public events for the rest of 2024, which is not a good sign.
No.
I mean, I think Charles has handled it reasonably well. It's tough to follow a successful.
Well, just from the perspective of one American that loves going to London maybe as much as any place on earth, as long as the people over there want it, I like all of the royal stuff. I mean, I find it kind of fascinating. I like to look at the palace and all the parks, and, you know, it doesn't bother me in the least. And, yeah, you know, I wish the guy kind of was my age and, you know, was in waiting for a long time. Then he finally grabs a prize and he gets cancer. And, you know, I don't know. I have some sympathy for him. I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And I think he's worn it reasonably well. He's a bit less crabby and impatient. I mean, it's harder for him to disguise his political leanings. His mother, we really couldn't guess. Right. With him, he's sort of center-leftish. You know, he'd like to be back in the European Union.
Well, I know I speak for Al when I say this, and I always show you are, frankly, our favorite guest. You were the first guest we ever had, and you've probably been on as much a board as any other guest. And I think today's conversation proved it. I mean, we covered everything in the world from Europe to China to elections to the heat, to climate, to Brexit, to God knows what's not. So I look forward to seeing you again, Ed, and thank you very much for being such a great friend of our shows. We're very proud of our relationship.
Well, you're my favorite podcast. I enjoy appearing on yours more than any, and that's not me. Just
well, you make us look good because we learn a lot, and our listeners learn a lot from you, Ed Luce. I second everything James just said. You are our favorite guest, so you're going to come. We're not going to wait for your Brzezinski book, which is going to come out in about a year. We'll have you on as soon as it comes out, but we're going to have you on before that.
Anytime, I love to come on.
All right, best to your wife, and thank you, Ed Luce.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, now for the outrage of the week. James, there is so much to be outraged about. But instead this week, I want to honor a remarkable man I never met and so wish I had, Bill Walton, who passed away at age 71. Walton, under the great John Wooden at UCLA, was arguably the greatest college basketball player. Three-time National Player of the Year, leading the Bruins to two national championships, in one of which he hit 21 of 22 field goal attempts. He won two NBA titles at Portland and later with the Celtics. He won one at Portland and one with the Celtics. But his professional career was stymied by serious injuries, causing him to miss multiple seasons. Without injuries, he would have been one of the GOAT centers of all times, with Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain. He may have been an even more interesting person off the court. The proud San Diego native brought a zest to everything he did in his larger-than-life persona. He went to an estimated 1,000 Grateful Dead concerts, once playing the drums with them. As a broadcaster, he brought intelligence and enthusiasm that made any game fun to watch. James, we don't like to stay up late. We complain about games that go on, you know, too late for us. I sometimes stayed up well past my bedtime to watch a Walton commentary on a Pac-12 basketball game that I otherwise had no interest. How Arizona State did against Washington State really wasn't on my radar screen. Bill Walton was. Of the many fabulous personal stories about Walton this week, let me just relate two. When his son was in the NBA playoffs and Walton was bedridden, he'd disguise his voice, pretending to be a player with an opposing team, and leave a phone message with his son that said, "We're going to kick your butt." Inspired his son. And he was a free spirit, and Coach John Wooden was a straight arrow. Yet they had enormous respect and love for one another. When the old coach was in his 90s and fragile, Walton would call him twice a week, just to chat and boost his spirits. Bill Walton lived a full life virtually every moment. He was kind, he was generous, and he brought joy to all around him. Bill Walton, thank you. You were a great presence. You will be missed.
Yeah, I actually did meet him one time. It was in an elevator at the Ritz-Carlton in Philadelphia. And he said, "Hi, James, I'm Bill Walton." I said, "Well, I kind of knew you were." And he was just couldn't have been a nicer guy. But a fitting tribute to not just a great athlete, but a fascinating human being. So is that outrage? It's just an idea. It's a, but the anti-corporate feeling in the United States right now is probably as deep as any time that I've seen it. It was a good piece. I think it was David Leon Hart, but talking about how, and I know my friend Senator Casey's talking about shrinkflation. I know Senator Testa's talking about this. I've never seen a time in politics where there have been more sympathy for workers than there are right now. And that UAW strike was a really good example of it. Even when it went to organize a automobile plant in Alabama, the union side got very close. I think it's just a matter of time before they're going to get over there. Biden needs to take up this anti-corporate feeling, raise the goddamn, he's for it, but no one would know it, raise the minimum wage to $15. We're not doing that well with younger people, and we're certainly not doing that well with black folks. And you give, this country needs a raise, and I'm going to give it to them. And we know that all of this old bullshit about it destroys jobs, it's just not true. There have been study after study after study. And when you raise the minimum wage, you raise wages to, you know, if somebody's minimum wages, you go look at a chart, historic value of minimum wage, it make you throw up. And we got to quit worrying about hurting somebody's feelings. Are they not going to feel good? Are they going to say you're a job destroyer? All of the shit they always say. And we got to get out there and get after a higher minimum wage. We got to get out there and get after all this price fixing and shrinkflation and everything else that's going on. And we got to quit worrying about hurting somebody's feelings. And it doesn't, it's not overly left wing to say people ought to make earn a living wage.
Above the poverty line.
Yes, Florida voted 67%. To raise it. God damn it, put it front and center. Let somebody say, it's not a new idea. Who gives a shit? It's a good idea. And it says that you see it. You know, and you go to minimum wage and you're going to crack down on price fixing and you're going to score political points because everybody knows these airlines are rigging prices. Everybody knows these pharmaceutical companies are rigging prices. Everybody knows that these fast food companies are rigging prices. People are not stupid. But you got to show them that you're on their side. And if it risks getting some heat from, you know, some donors about you're too populist, take the fucking heat. You got to stand up here. And all these Senate candidates are running ahead and they're running better than Biden. And the reason is that they're running a campaign that recognized how corporate America is not that popular anymore. In fact, they're very unpopular for a very good reason. And go out.
I'd add Sherrod Brown to that.
You're absolutely.
Too. I think you're absolutely.
The whole bunch of them. But that's why these guys are being successful. And, you know, what Senator Casey has done is run against this sort of shrinkflation that everybody is aware of. You know, it's not a pound of coffee anymore. Shit, you're lucky if you get 12 ounces. And they do it again and again and again. And there's more than just economic forces at work here. And the one thing that Adam Smith couldn't stand was monopolies and price fixes. And that's what this economy is full of.
Boy, it sure is. Okay. Okay, James, now our always excellent questions from our always high-quality listeners. We'll start with Early in Huntington Beach, California, who asks, will we ever eliminate the Electoral College and choose our presidents and vice presidents according to a majority of the popular vote?
So there's a guy in San Francisco this is his lifetime obsession. And God damn it, I can't think of his name, but I know more than I can. I just, for the life of me, I don't see how this happens. That the one way that it might happen is this popular vote thing in the state legislature, where when enough states have total 270 electoral votes pass it, the state legislatures would instruct their electors to vote for the winner of the popular vote. I don't think you can. I don't think you're ever going to be able to do it by constitutional amendment, because North Dakota is not going to give up the power to have vis-a-vis California. It's just not,
right.
Doesn't make any sense. But there is that thing that you can look up where you can circumvent the Constitution. And the number of states that they've gotten to do this are about, you know, they're not close, but they got quite a few. And if you get, you know, you get some online, that's a possibility. But I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
The next question, I agree with you. I think it should, but it won't be North Dakota. It'll be a whole bunch of states.
Delaware's not going to go along with that. Well,
neither is Alabama. No, neither is a whole bunch of states. The next question comes from Greg in Atlanta, who said, if Biden's debate performance is especially dismal next month, it's a high risk, high reward, and we have additional, you know, bad swing state polls, could there be a move of party leaders like Obama, Coons, Pelosi to persuade the president off the ticket? I'm sorry, Greg, train's left the station. It's not going to happen. I think a particularly dismal performance next week might mean next month, rather, might mean curtains. But Joe Biden is somehow convinced that he's the one that can beat Donald Trump. I just think that's wrong, but he believes that. And it's not necessarily wrong he can beat him. There are stronger candidates. He doesn't believe that. And I don't think anything is going to get him off the ticket right now other than a health issue.
You're probably right. But I got to tell you, this, I don't say panic. There is real, real unease in the party.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it sometimes you go years with nothing happening, and then you go weeks with everything happening. And, you know, I think you're right, but, you know, it's politics. Anything can happen. Don't discount it. I think you and I agree on, I don't think there's going to be a debate, because I don't think Trump is going to debate him.
Well, that's interesting, because the next question comes from Tony in Larkspur, California, and he wants to know, let's just assume there is one. I think you may be right.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I have any inside information. It's just, I've just described myself as skeptical.
Right. But Tony wants to know, if there is one, what would be your advice to President Biden going in? Tony thinks he ought to be cool, calm, and everything else. But what are your thoughts, James?
I think that, first of all, he should call Trump the former president. And I think he should look into the camera, and I've said this before, and say, I will interview every potential judicial nominee in the Supreme Court and senior federal courts, and I'll ask them if they agree that there's an inherent right to privacy, as I do. And if they answer yes, I'll ask them if they think the Supreme Court should be subjected to the same ethics rules as federal district courts. Draw that distinction right there. I would call it an inherent right to privacy. Everyone knows what you're talking about. Then I would be very clear that it's time to give America a raise, and we're going to do that. We're going to raise the minimum wage to $15. And we're going to, quite candidly, get rid of the tax cuts for people making over $400,000. They've done no good for the economy. All they've done is make rich people even richer. And we're going to use that money to give some relief to these younger voters who are unable to buy a house, who are unable to afford an education, who don't see themselves as part of the future of the United States. And it's time that people who have done well in this country pony up, and we need to give a helping hand to our younger generation. And just do that. And everybody knows what a freaking criminal he is. And don't spend a whole lot of time fact-checking him or correcting him. You just say that everybody knows that's not true. Former president knows that's not true. Why is he saying it? I have no idea. And then move on. But go in and hit hard. And tell people, no one has any idea of what he wants to do. I mean, we're in this election. If it turns out, well, you're better off under me. No, you're better off under me. I know you're better off under me. talk about where you're going to be going forward, of which there is no discussion other than Trump telling all companies they can write their own fucking plan. Pick up this issue. Pick up that issue, right? But just be simple, be direct. Don't try to execute too much. Talk about the court. Talk about distrust of corporate America, and you'll win the debate if you do that.
Yeah, I agree, and I agree with Tony that he ought to be cool and calm, and don't let Trump either set the agenda or rattle you. Ignore him when possible. I mean, he'll try to be crazy because he is crazy, and he'll do it to try to unnerve you. Just, you know, have the discipline just to say there's a crazy man in the room.
Right.
You know, it's not me.
Right.
So I think
what he wants to do is just get out what he wants to do and contrast it clearly and plainly with Trump. And don't fall into all this bullshit.
You know, John in St. Louis asked, what do you think the chances are the Democrats will line up disenchanted ex-Trump officials to speak at the convention to endorse Biden? I think there will be some, for sure. There's certainly going to be a bunch of Republicans. And who would I like to see? I'd like to see a select group. I'd like to see Jim Mattis and Esper, former defense secretaries, and John Bolton, who I've often disagreed with, maybe Rex Tillerson. And what they ought to say is they don't even barely have to mention Biden. And also I'd add certainly John Kelly to that list. Just say what they believe and what they tell people, that Donald Trump is an existential threat to America's national security. He would endanger our standing in the world. You know, I don't think a whole lot of ex-Republicans talking about Biden is going to make a whole lot of difference. I think people who were around him, you know, might.
I agree. And I think there's going to be a robust plan to do this, not just at the convention, but I think there'll be people coming along in October. And I think it's very important that you kind of space everything. Where you keep the story, you keep kicking a story about just how dangerous he is. The other thing, Al, that I've become big on and is running hard against MAGA. And I would run, and the reason is that MAGA has a 24% approval rating. And Trump has like
a 42. Poll, right.
Yeah, it has like a 42. And there, but when you talk about MAGA, you're reminding people about extreme everything is. And you're given permission. So if I voted for Trump, which we need people that voted for Trump, we need people that voted for Trump in 2020, that might have voted for Trump in 2016, to basically infer that what's happened is he's been captivated by this crazy wing of the Republican Party. Therefore, you have permission to change your mind now. You didn't necessarily make a mistake in the front face. You didn't realize that he'd be completely overtaken by MAGA. I think that it's not as satisfying a message as some Democrats want, but I think it's a satisfying message to give people some sense of permission that they can move away from Trump. When we need some of these people, we just do.
Yep. No question. James Paul in San Francisco says, why is Biden sounding more and more like politicians in my one-party city-state? Why has he abandoned the center?
I don't know if that's – honestly, I don't think that President Biden's abandoned the center. I do think that he pays the too solicitous to the left-wing part of the Democratic Party. It is not that big. It is not that powerful. They've been wrong, in my opinion. The entire Western left has been probably wrong about everything for the last 100 years. And they're too solicitous to them. They got them trapped in an early border policy. The whole anti-police thing was as stupid, as dumber than goddamn concrete. And, you know, they're not doing that well. By the way, that Pramila Jayapal, her sister lost the Democratic primary. It's not that Biden doesn't have a center-left view of the world that I share. These people are nowhere near as powerful as the White House thinks they are, and they're nowhere near as central to the Democratic coalition as the White House thinks they are. And I got to give a tip of the hat to Senator Bernie Sanders, who sees this and is 100% behind President Biden, is that it's stupid demands. There's I'll tell you how silly these people are. There's an equal rights amendment, and Virginia passed it, and it became enough, two-thirds of three-quarters of the states. But the Bush administration under Bill Barr said that in enabling legislation, it didn't meet the time period, that Congress had put a time for ratification. The Biden Justice Department agreed with that decision. And now people are talking about going in the states and telling people not to vote if Biden doesn't make this part of the federal registry. Oh, I think that kind of stuff is just painfully stupid. Painfully stupid. But but that's the left for you. I don't know the facts.
Maybe we ought to tell some of those people, James, what happened to their predecessors in 2000 who said, don't vote for Al Gore.
Right.
Vote for Ralph Nader. And said, what happened? I mean, what happened? I mean, Al Gore, you know, didn't turn out so well, did it?
No, it really didn't. Think of Sam Alito. I think of Jill Stein in 2016, who got more votes than Hillary lost by. And we keep falling for these people. And I'm more worried about Cornel West than Bobby Kennedy. But I don't know. You know.
Well, you may be right, except I haven't checked this. I have to. I just don't know how many ballots he's going to be
on. Yeah, I don't either. Jill Stein is... You know, they had to get her share. But, you know, shit, right now, we could easily be lining up for Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. Now, I did see something encouraging I wanted to bring up. So there's this fear that we win the Nebraska congressional seat, or Nebraska 2, I think it is.
Right.
And the Nebraska legislature would force the electors to not use that one electoral vote, which we would need. I've read, this is encouraging, that the Maine legislature, which is Democratic, if they did that in a Republican carried Maine too, they would say you have to vote for the Democrat. So that there's some safety valve there. But to get to 270, you got to carry the predicted blue states plus the three upper north central states, and you have to get either Nebraska or Maine to get to 270. That's not a scenario that you can just dismiss as out of the question. In fact, it's a scenario that, because it's likely, but it's clearly within the realm of the possible. And we should
I mean, you're so right, because if Biden did that, and he lost Arizona, and he lost Nevada, and he lost Georgia,
all
of which he carried last time, and North Carolina, which he hopes to be competitive on. If he won that blue wall, those three states, and Nebraska too, he would have 270.
Right.
So it could be very important.
Yes. I don't know where it's going to go, but that scenario is not hard to see.
I agree.
I saw that about the Maine legislature. You know, it made me feel 15% better.
Yeah. James, Charlie in Scranton, Pennsylvania, Joe Biden's birthplace. A lot of great politicians, as you know, are from Scranton, Pennsylvania. Says, Charlie got a good question. Should Biden's team get legitimate estimates of what people's personal health insurance premiums would go up if Trump is able to end Obamacare and mail flyers to voters? Absolutely, yes, Charlie. I think this is the underrated issue of 2004. ACA, which now is popular, Trump says he's going to end it, and drug prices. And Biden has put a cap, Biden and the Congress put a cap on a number of drug prices and insulin, and you can rest assured that Trump and the Republicans, if they take control, will take those caps off. And if they end the ACA, a lot of people are not only going to be uninsured, but those who are insured will have skyrocketing health insurance premiums. That is something they ought to emphasize with great specificity.
Agree. in that, in combination with the tax cuts over $400,000 coming into focus in the first year of whoever the next president is, gives us a great launching point. Yeah. What I would like to see is really good research on the Republicans and birth control, because they have a lot of anti-birth control stuff out there. They have a lot of anti-birth control stuff they've voted for. And I think that's the creme de la creme issue that brings the whole women's health issue into focus, brings it into everybody. But don't kid yourself. The Republican Party and many members of the Supreme Court have expressed real skepticism about the idea of birth control. And I don't need to tell you how popular that idea is in the country. And we should lay the predicate and, yes, engage in a fear campaign, because it is a justified fear campaign.
And hammer it home.
And then just like they would say about the abortion, oh, there you go again. It's a false issue. You know, we respect the culture of life, and they're never going to do that. And you believed them, okay? You thought you were safe. You think Alito is going to keep your ass safe? Are you crazy? We got to be tougher and more direct on this kind of stuff. It's got to be kind of up and down. But before we go, I got to say this. Ed Luce might be the best 5-2 player in podcast history in terms of...
James, I have a contest. Let's see if we can find some place in the world that Ed Luce isn't an expert on. I don't know.
We go India to China to Russia to fucking Middle East to U.S. politics to British politics to economics. Guys just knowledgeable in everything you can imagine.
James, it's often said that the Brits sound smarter than we do. Ed is smarter.
He actually is. He actually is.
I got one more before we go ahead. And this is Billy in Bangkok, Thailand.
Wow.
I like that place. To bring it. I love Thailand. It's fabulous. Phuket is even better. Billy says, the ongoing southern border debacle upsets so many Americans. What can Biden do to seal the border and be victorious this November when Republicans will do everything possible to stymie him?
Well, I don't know if he can seal the border, if that's possible. But he can certainly, they have an answer. They had the legislation. They agreed to it. It was everything they wanted. And the Republicans killed it in their own self-interest. And the other thing they can do is my friend Colin Albert, and a billionaire Republican businessman from El Paso, said something that President Clinton's been on for a long time, is let these people work. Okay, all right, so the migrant comes here, they're filling up hotels. It's a real issue. They can't work. Shit, let them go to work while they're pending an asylum hearing or while they're pending whatever it is. You can kill two birds in one shot here. But I think that what happened is they listened to the idiot left, believed them, and it ended up a political disaster that I think that by agreeing to the legislation, the Lankford-Murphy legislation, the issue doesn't work for us, but it works less bad now. At least we have a good answer.
Well, that's right. And you saw that in New York 3, Tom Suozzi. He didn't run from immigration. He confronted it right away, and he embraced that Lankford-Murphy bill, which is the toughest immigration bill that's ever been up before the Congress. And I don't think you can win on it, James, but I think you can minimize your losses.
You can win on the minimum wage. You can win on Dobbs. You can win on birth control. You can win on a lot of things. You can't win on this, but you can sure in the hell take it off as a top issue, a disagreement. And you say, I got a plan. It's right there. It's called Lankford-Murphy. Call it whatever you want.
Bipartisan.
President agreed to it. The Border Patrol agents agreed to it. Why can't we do this simple thing? Why can't you just come out for this? I mean, you got a good answer now. It's something you never had before. In politics, an answer's good. Even if you can't be a winning issue, you don't have to dread it like you used to.
I agree. Okay. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Made, The Washington Post, and Ladder in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.